Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 9, delivered on February 12, 2013. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. Before I do that, I do want to bring up a few last pointers about financial analysis. I'm going to put up a quiz. I was going to put it up for tonight, but I think I'm going to make sure that I've got everything stable in ReggieNet before I do that. It'll be just a ratio analysis type of quiz, and I wanted to go through just a few items. I just wanted to go through a few items as far as financial ratios and analysis go before I go on to the main topic for today, just so you are comfortable with what you do on a quiz or on an exam for me in this regard. Now, I'll just pull a few ratios out of the air, and I'm specifically going to use Amazon.com for my for my example here. But just bear with me. I'm going to pull up an income statement here. It's not a statement, it's a comprehensive income. Well, that really helps. Consolidated balance sheets, consolidated statement of operations, cash flows, financial statements, net services, total net sales. Okay, well, that's interesting. But, okay, now, when you do a financial analysis, if you want to do it and do it seriously, yeah, you got to do the numbers, but really computers do these, Excel spreadsheets do these for us. More we can allow ourselves some time when we look at these financial statements to just say, well, what are we looking at here? I'm looking at Amazon.com, an absolutely enormous company, just to see what kind of an operation they have going here. You can see that their total net sales are just extraordinary, just huge. And if I wanted to start out, okay, let's say, okay, what has been their growth in total net sales? Now, remember that to find a percentage growth from year to year, you go N minus begin, all divided by begin, times 100%. So if I were to do that for Amazon.com, the first thing I do is, well, let's see what happened from fiscal year 2010 to 2011. You can see that it went from 34,204 up to 48,077. And if I were to run that thing through here very quickly, I would say 48,077 minus 34,204, and then take all of that divided by the beginning, 34,204, and you tell me if I've got this right, it looks to me as if they've got a 40.56% growth in total net sales from fiscal 2010 to fiscal 2011. Almost 41% growth. That's amazing. So let's take it the next year and say, well, how are they doing from fiscal 2011 to fiscal 2012? 61,093 minus 48,077, all of that divided by 48,077, 27.07%. So they went in from 2010 to 2011, they grew their net sales grew almost 41%. And then from 2011 to 2012, they made just a little, they grew a little over 27%. Now, thinking about this is kind of nuanced. There's not an absolutely right answer. So if I ask you, well, is this a bad sign, and you say the wrong thing, I won't say, well, you dumb shit. Okay? So is it a bad sign that they went from 44% growth in net sales to 27% growth in net sales year over year? Now remember, I'm not going to say anything bad to you if you said whichever way you say it.
Yeah.
Oh, you dumb shit. No. Okay, on the one hand, that is obviously their net sales grow, decline. But at the same time, that's a little bit worrying. You're absolutely right. At the same time, there are a couple of things that I can argue. Okay, one, there was a recession. But really, we're crawling out of a recession. So that's not a very good excuse at this point in the business cycle. Another way we could say, oh, it's not a bad sign, is that we're talking about something that has grown enormously. And it's gotten to the point where it is so huge that further growth is probably not going to be as great as it was. The period when you grew from the age of 0 to 20, you grew a lot. But growing from 20 to 40, it's all going to be just that. Okay, you're going to get a pot belly, you'll probably have a prostate problem, you know, the whole nine yards. So growth will slow as the company becomes larger and larger. You cannot expect 44% growth forever and ever. In fact, there would be reasons why I wouldn't want to see a company just keep growing and growing and growing at an insanely fast pace. There are good reasons why those are the kinds of companies that can flame out very quickly if they don't stop it, if they don't knock it off and start thinking about, well, how are we going to handle this larger and larger size? Something you'll find right now is that Walmart, which has grown to an enormous size, so large that it is actually a macroeconomic force, is struggling with growing anymore at this point because it's gotten so large that further growth is going to be a rather difficult thing for it. Okay. So that's just one thing that we could do to just talk about. Let's talk about the net, the company has grown, but it is net sales wise, but it has grown at a slowing pace. You go down there to the net income. Oh my, what's happened? What do you look at net income? Look at the net income. What do you see? Yeah. It went from a net income fiscal 2010. Ow, God, that hurt like hell. 2010, 1,152, slid almost half, fell almost half to 631, and then a slight loss, $39 billion. That's a little bit concerning. That is a real bad sign right there. Looking back up, what in the world was causing that kind of a bleed off? Technology and content looks like a little bit of an issue. Interest, notice how they're cutting their interest income, their interest expense. Well, I'm sorry, their interest expense is growing, but it's not growing very rapidly. Something is really wrong here with this picture. If you look at it, it looks as if this is a company that seems to be actually struggling. Let's look at their cost of sales. The growth in cost of sales was 26,561 to 37,288, 10 to 11. 37,288 minus what was that cost of sales on the other one? 26,561. 26,561. All of that divided by 26,561. And I get their cost of sales rose 40%. Sales, remember, rose 44%. Cost of sales rose 40%. Decent. But now, if we look at the next year, we went cost of sales 37,288 to 45,971. So 45,971 less 27,288. Oops. 27,288 divided by, no, I screwed that up, 45,971 minus 37,288. Let me do that again. 45,971 minus 37,288. I'm not going to get this. 45, looks like my calculator is beginning to give out on me. 971 minus 37,288. Divided by 37,288. Their costs grew 23%. Now, that's an interesting thing because their cost of sales actually fairly closely mirrored their growth. Their cost of sales fairly mirrored their growth in sales. If anything, they were able to achieve a little bit less of a growth in cost of sales than their growth in 2011 to 2012. So I can't simply explain it. Well, their wholesale costs went up. That doesn't cut it here. Something deeper is going wrong here. And that is a concern to me. Does that mean I've got a sell signal here? Absolutely not. But I would sure get interested in going through the ratios and just not just do the ratios. And you'll have plenty of time to practice with those, with some problems I'm giving you on ReggieNet. But more than that, just simply looking at why this is happening. What is the detail that's causing all of this to go on? One thing that I might suspect, well, how are they doing on capital purchases? Capital purchases, consolidated balance sheets. Really, that helped. There we go. Comprehensive income, statement of operations. That's not helping me at all. They've got something wrong here. Something is really seriously defective in these financial statements. Statement of cash flow, statement of operations, consolidated statement, consolidated comprehensive income, consolidated balance. There we go. There we go. And now always these are just going to be for 2 years. You're going to see reported. But current assets went up, clearly. Here's something, goodwill went up. That means they paid more than the asset market, the asset value, so they marked the extra to goodwill. Their total assets went up pretty good. I'm staring at this. Their long-term debt jumped. They're borrowing a lot of money. So are they borrowing that money so that they can buy fixed assets? Oh, look at that. You see it? Look how much their fixed assets, property and equipment, jumped. That's probably about 70% just off the top of my head, something like that. And so they financed that. Look, you see how they financed it? You can look at that. It just as a speculation, and this is just purely off the top of my head, out my ass, it looks like they are in some kind of a period where they're slowing down, building out their base so that they can have another growth spurt. So my first reaction, well, maybe I should start thinking about a self signal. This tells me, no, that probably isn't a good idea. It looks like they are getting their wind, they're slowing down for their next big burst, their next big run, whatever it's going to be. One other thing that's also, just for investment analysis purposes, look how much cash they have. Look at how much their cash has grown. Okay? Now, why would I care about how much cash? One thing that's bad about that is when you have a lot of cash, that means you're not using it, because cash means you're not putting it in the best yielding long-term investments. So that always worries me a little bit when cash is ballooning. But what else about that? Madam, is there any reason why I would get really excited seeing all that cash? Yeah, I could get someone to go to Denny's. Grand Slam, $8 for the whole thing. Is that when you see, we use terms like, this is a cash flush corporation, or this company has a great deal of liquidity, just spinning around in the water looking for a target to go after. This is a company that has the potential, whether or not it's going to do it, it has the potential to be a predator, to go after something, big, or a bunch of things that are small. But when you see cash, you look at it and you say, okay, on the downside, this cash is not earning them anything. You can't, cash in your pocket isn't earning a return for you. But if you say, are they building cash so that they can go after something? Well, then that would be the kind of thing that would be a buy signal. This company is possibly preparing take over a market. Then the next question is, what would it be after? That's hard to tell. I mean, you can guess all you want. Right now, there was this bizarre speculation over the weekend. It came out of CNBC's commentator named Kramer, otherwise known as the dumbest ass on earth. Who said that, well, it would be a great idea if Facebook bought LinkedIn. And of course, that would be the end of LinkedIn. LinkedIn would just, everyone would leave LinkedIn who had any self-respect at all if that happened. But that's when you start listening to the street. What's available? What is buyable? What is weak but valuable? What is looking for a takeover partner? then you say, all right, Amazon, would it stay in its current line of business? It seems to be interested in a lot of things, media, multimedia, things like that. It might look for a target that it would be interested in. That's when this financial analysis begins to have teeth, because you can start to speculate and maybe do minor investments on the side to say, this might be something Amazon would be interested in. If it is, that target is going to go up in price real fast once the rumors start swirling on the street about it. So there you go. That's why I want to just bring up some of this stuff. And I will give you this ratio sheet and some practice, and then I'll have a quiz up for the weekend on it. Now let me get on to the main topic for today, which has to do with risk and return. Let's start with a couple of quick things here. I'm looking around the room here for some... You look like a risk taker. A person who would probably drive a Harley on the back wheel. You'd listen to both kinds of music, country and western. Yeah, you see, some people are just naturally riskier people who are more willing to take risks than others. I brought this up before. All people, every individual has a certain risk preference. It is partly ingrained in you from your family, from your genetics, and from your life experiences. It's also partly a function of how old you are. Someday, you are going to be a very old man. Ugly, miserable, you'll have tubes coming out of your kidneys. You don't want risk on that money that you got in the bank, because that's what you have to buy your cat food with to eat. Okay? And your Viagra. As if you needed it. No. But you see, when you are young, you can recover from a risk that you have taken. There's also another thing about it, too. The opportunity cost of your time goes up as you get older. When you are 50 years old, you'll be making some money. More than you can right now. Your earnings power will be higher. Maybe if we were to put it in a dollars per hour term, maybe $75 to $100 an hour. Right now, what can you make? $10, $8, something like that an hour? So, you, if you were to talk about risk of going to jail for trying something, it's cheaper for you to be in jail for a year now than it would be when you're 50 years old, you see. A year in jail now, you know, you meet some friends, you get married, when you're 50, you're like, I don't have time for you, Bubba. Leave me alone. You see, as you get older, you become more risk averse just because your opportunity costs, your loss becomes more a greater problem for you. And that's, by the way, an interesting thing about corporations, too, is that as they age, they will naturally become less innovative, less risk-taking in their behaviors, simply because they have more to lose by taking those risks than companies that are young. Also, and I'll bring this up as a side point, recently a study was released looking at innovation in companies that are private versus public. It was quite clear that once a company goes public, it begins to lose its innovative edge, its willingness to innovate, its willingness to push boundaries. And the reasons for that are obvious. Right now, you're not married, are you? Good. Don't. No, anyway. So you answer only to yourself, like a private corporation. It answers only to its inside owner clique. But once you get married, you answer, oh Lord, you answer, to a woman, to these snot-nosed kids who are so ungrateful that they just treat you like... you will answer to a lot of external agents that you don't have to answer to when you are a private company. So even in the risk profile of companies,
young versus old, private versus public, all of those come into play in the risk decision that is made.
Now, let me take you on a little bit of a journey here. Get this off the board here for a minute. Now, the first thing that I had brought up before, and I'll emphasize this point again, just so that you don't forget one of those mighty important points. Really? Okay. Those important points. Risk. First of all, there are two kinds of risk. There is stupid risk, and we will label that poopid. That is diversifiable risk. Risk that you can get rid of. Risk that no one in the world is going to give you a penny for taking. And you should not expect it. And then there is smart risk. That is non-diversifiable. Now, make sure you get this in your notes. Non-diversifiable risk is sometimes called systematic. It's in the system. You can't get it out. This is non-diversifiable risk. I'm sorry, diversifiable risk is called non-systematic. It's not in the system. Woman, you're walking along, and I see a spider sitting on your forehead. You know what I'll do? I'll just slap it off. I might, you know, hit your face, but, you know, it's because I care. Like that. Non-systematic. You can get rid of it. Okay, now. On the other hand, a few days later, you say, I'm really not feeling well. Did you ever see that movie Alien? Okay, it was about these things that get inside you, and then they grow, and then they pop out your chest. Okay? I can't get rid of that. I can't, you know, you're dead. I mean, the thing pops out, and I say, you know, it sucks to be you. Someone get me some fly spray. See, some things I can just get rid of. I don't get a reward for them. Other things, I'm not going to be able to do anything about it. It's there forever. And so, this is the smart risk, this systematic risk, this non-diversifiable risk, is the risk for which I should expect return. I should expect a return for that kind of a risk. This, you don't get anything. You come up nada, but this. You take it, by all means, enjoy it. You're not going to get any reward for it whatsoever. So in finance, we don't even look at this risk. If you want to take it, it's your thing, but you don't have to take it. You're not going to get a reward for it. So you can brag all you want about price volatility of a stock, but at the same time, all that means is that you are taking on a hell of a lot of risk that you don't have to take. The myth and the reality of what happens in trading, stock market trading, works like this. The myth, the more volatility, the better. The reality, they say volatility, but they react on the part of it that cannot be removed. So if I see any kind of a security, if I were to see a security with this kind of insane volatility, I don't really care what that volatility is. What I care about is the part of that volatility that is actually something that I could not get rid of by buying a well-diversified portfolio. And I've talked about that before. You see, you could have a stock that is insanely volatile, but the part of it for which you should expect a return, it's actually a tame pussycat, comparatively speaking. So this is one of those things where you have to watch out for the thing, well, you should buy a single stock. You buy a single stock, you're on a roller coaster. But you're not going to get rewarded. You should not expect a reward for most of that roller coaster. All you should expect a reward for is that little tiny piece that is you can't get rid of. Now, I've brought this up before. This is a repeat, just for the sake to make sure you know. The number of shares in your portfolio, of different stocks in your portfolio, and the total risk of that portfolio, the number of different types, different companies in your portfolio. Okay, if you have one share, one stock in your portfolio, you have got this insane amount of risk. I mean, stocks, if you look at most stocks, they are volatile as hell. They just go up and down, up and down. But if you were to put another stock in there, you would notice that the portfolio's performance was less volatile than either of the pieces, provided that they weren't perfectly correlated stocks. In other words, there's got to be some way, a little bit, at least a little bit, where they cancel each other out in their volatility. Put three in, four in. The more stocks you put in, you'll see that the total risk just keeps declining, but it is declining towards what I'm sure you remember in math, or at least you heard the term, an asymptote. It's working its way down to some base level of risk. That base level of risk is the systematic, non-diversifiable risk. You can't get rid of it by diversification. This is the part for which you will expect a reward. You might not get it, but you can expect it. Now, as I had told you before, if you had the complete market portfolio, every stock in the market, in proportion to its contribution to the overall cap of the market. In other words, tiny companies, you'd have just a little tiny bit. Huge companies, you have significantly more. You get down to the risk of the market portfolio. Or I should say the expected risk. Market portfolio. And I even have a label for that. It's K sub M. Okay, how many stocks should you have? Well, the market portfolio is theoretically you could buy it, but in practice, no. 30 stocks gets you almost all of the non-diversifiable risk out. Now, does that mean that you have to buy 30 stocks to do this? Actually, that's not a very good idea because the transactions cost would kill you buying all that and keeping the balance of it as the stocks shifted in their weights in the economy. There are two ways that you can do it. One way is with mutual funds. And this is a little bit of a repeat of a lecture from before, but I want to just get risk and return off the table today. Mutual funds. And they are very popular. They have been. Always look for something that's a no-load or a low-load fund. In other words, something where there's not a lot of money or no money you have to put in. Some of these funds, they want you to pay them a rather serious amount of money to join their club. There's not really any reason to, because there are plenty out there that'll let you join for free. Mutual funds buy stocks, and then you buy a piece of the mutual fund action. And the mutual fund managers keep the mutual fund in balance. You can get mutual funds that are technology-related, agriculture-related, metals-related, international. You can get all kinds. The downside of them is that you can trade them only a specific number of times a year. So if you decided that you wanted to move to a fund that had a different balance or a different emphasis,
maybe one that had more bonds and fewer stocks, or one that had more stocks and fewer bonds. You can do that only in specific number of times a year. So if you're not, if you've used up your times, or if you're not in a time when you can do it, you can get your ass beaten with these. However, they do tend to perform. A couple of things that you want to watch out for, and here's where we get some investment advice, give you some investment advice. Look behind the mutual fund. Look at the management fees. Look how much the managers are sucking out of the fund for themselves. Is it 0.5%, 1%, 2%? Look for something where the management fees are modest, are decent. The managers deserve money for what they do. They don't deserve to become kings and queens for what they do. So look at your management fees. Second thing you look at. Don't just look at the return of the fund. That's one of the big problems with a lot of these TV shows on financial news networks and things like that. Well, this upstanding stud had the highest return on his mutual fund last year. Ha ha ha! Isn't he the fabulous human being of the century? They don't ever explain to you that risk and return are related. He had a very high return. Well, good for him. Give him a cookie, pat him on the butt. Did he take a lot of risk? Did he take more risk than you want to bear? He got a 30% return on his mutual fund? Wonderful. He might have taken so much risk that you would probably have a mess in your diaper if you had known that was what he was doing to get that kind of a return. So it's not all about return. It's looking at the risk that has been taken with that return. And I'm going to show you how to look at risk here. I'm going to pull up some data here in just a couple of minutes here so you can actually see this thing in action here. Let me check something here real quick. Okay, I'm all good. Okay, so the next thing is return versus risk when you're looking at a mutual fund. You can see a staggering return, but there's a lot of risk. You can see a smaller return. Oh, that sucks. I don't want that. That's the return was only 8% last year. Yeah, but that might be the risk that you are actually commensurate with. We have found in a number of studies where we look at what people say about their risk preferences versus what they actually do as far as their risk behaviors are concerned in financial terms, we find that there are a lot of people who are pretty dishonest with themselves. Well, I'm a risk-taking kind of person. Yeah, uh-huh. No, you're not. You are a coward. There's nothing wrong with that. You'll probably survive a lot longer than the battlefield warriors will. So know your risk and understand that that's going to be very related to the return that you're going to get off your securities investments. Okay, take that off the table. If you don't want this limit on how many transactions you can do a year, then you probably would rather go into electronically traded funds, ETFs. ETFs are just stock shares. You buy a share of an ETF, and what you have done is you have bought a share of a portfolio. And it trades just like a share of stock. You can buy and sell them anytime, day or night, as much as you want. You can get an ETF that was a highly, highly market-oriented portfolio, something that was virtually the market itself, like the S&P 500. You could buy an ETF, a share of the Standard & Poor's 500 index, or any index you want. All kinds of ETFs are out there. They trade just like shares, so you don't have this limit on your transactions like you do with mutual funds. You can precisely balance to your risk preferences. You can find your risk, and then you can play it for the expected return commensurate with that risk. There you go. The problem, of course, though, is that whereas you can get no-load mutual funds, with an ETF, every time you buy or sell a share of an ETF, you're paying the brokerage fee. Whether it's a full brokerage fee or a discount brokerage fee, you are paying every time you play that stock. So that's the downside, is that you can get eaten alive. You might make really great returns on an ETF, but if you go back and look at how much you paid in brokerage fees for all those trades as you were jockeying around, you find out you actually took an ass bath. So that's why you want to be careful. ETFs are fun as
all get out. They're really a treat to play. And you also know that you are actually targeting something. You couldn't buy the S&P 500 portfolio, but now you can with ETFs. Now you can. There's an end point to this, trust me. Okay. So how do we tell how risky a stock is? The first thing that we would want to do is we would say, okay, I can always buy a completely risk-free investment. I can buy a treasury bill. Has no risk. The government's never going to go bankrupt. It's no risk whatsoever. A short-term one-year T-bill, three-month T-bill, perfectly riskless. So I can always get a riskless return. So the first thing I would want to look at for any investment would be this K sub M minus K sub L. The expected return to the market minus the risk-free rate. We call that the expected market premium. If I ever don't say the word expected, know that it's there. Everything is about expectations because we can't tell the future. I know that you are going to die. I don't know when. I don't know that. I know that you're going to eat food again. I don't know when. See, so I have an expectation that you will die. I have an expectation that you will go for some noms, but I don't know when. So if I don't say the word expectation, it's always there because we have no crystal ball. So this K sub M, the expected return to the market portfolio, minus the risk-free rate is what we call the expected market premium over risk-free. In other words, in taking risk in a market portfolio, which would be a perfectly well-diversified portfolio, how much more do you expect to make than if you had just put your money on the sure bet? Okay. Now, for any stock, I need a way to measure it relative to the market portfolio. This expected premium. Is my expectation for this stock, is that return going to be more than the market premium or less than the market premium? So what we use is this animal called beta. And I'll put a beta sub S. This is the beta of a security. And every security has a beta. It is a factor. It is the factor that magnifies, that represents the magnification or the suppression of the risk of a stock over the market premium. So beta sub S times K sub M minus K sub F represents how much more or less than the expected market premium a specific stock will give me. Again, it measures how much more or how much less than the market premium a specific stock will give me. And one last thing about the expected return to a stock. Every stock had damn well better be able to give me more than the risk-free rate, because otherwise I'll just buy a government T-bill. So no matter what the expected return to a specific stock is, it has to at least give me the risk-free rate. So the expected return to any stock, and this is actually for any security, is going to be, I will get the risk-free rate. Every stock had better do that for me or the stock's gone. Plus, this magnification or suppression of the market premium. See this beta? That's what we are interested in. Let me show you. Let's look at some betas. And I'm going to probably use some lame service to do this. Where the hell did I put my glass? There it is. Okay. I'm going to show you some lame stuff here. Let me turn this off. So I'm going to go here, and I'll probably do something really lame, like use finance. Well, why don't I just do this? .msn.com. Did that really work? No, that didn't work. Okay, money. Markets. Get a quote. Okay, here. Let's try something. Apple. Yes. Okay, let's look at the market information. I'm going to go and look, okay, high, low, close. Those are fun to look at. You can talk about them at the restaurant. You might get laid talking about it. But dividend rate, dividend yield, bid, ask, 52-week high and low. Why does this suck? PD ratio, prop, here we go. Beta. One of the most important things you'll look at. This beta, now remember, the market portfolio itself has a beta of 1. It's 100% of the market. So when I see a beta of 1.04, that would mean that it has 104% of the systematic risk of the market portfolio. In other words, the market portfolio has 100% of its own risk. Apple has 104% of the systematic risk. This is not the total risk. Beta measures only the systematic risk. So this would magnify the market premium by just 4%. You would say that this is a stock that would be very much like the market portfolio. Don't let me trip you up on an exam. If I said something to the effect, okay, Apple is 104% of the market portfolio. So if you just bought Apple, you'd have almost just the market portfolio, right? So why don't you just buy Apple instead of worrying about ETFs and mutual funds and diversification portfolio? Apple's got 104% of the market portfolio, systematic risk, so just buy Apple. That is, okay, the technical term for that is that's bull. No, because beta measures only the systematic component of the risk. Remember how I showed you that a stock can be wildly volatile on its own, but its systematic risk component can be mild. Apple, I don't know how volatile it is, but if you hold that one without a diversified portfolio, you're in for a real bronco ride, because there's a lot more volatility than what beta is telling you. Beta is telling you what part of that volatility you should expect to be rewarded for bearing. That's all that tells you. And that's the only thing that matters, too. So if you were to buy a stock with a beta of exactly 1.00, that's asking for trouble. Let's go down the grinder here. Let's try something else. Let's do MSFT. Microsoft. Beta. It is slightly less risky than the market portfolio. Again, your interpretation is, okay, this is 94% of the market portfolio's systematic risk. Systematic risk. So this would be in a portfolio, if you were trying to make a portfolio that was not quite as wild as the market itself is, you would form a portfolio around stocks like Microsoft, a little bit lower. AMZN. Let's try AMZN. I don't even know myself these days. But I don't watch some of these. AMZN. Let's see what its beta is. Oh, even a lower beta. Isn't that interesting? And you saw that in those financials. Do you remember how you saw how its growth of sales revenue was slowing and all that kind of stuff? That's a sign
of a company that's becoming older and less exciting. So its beta is actually kind of reflecting that. This stock in a well-diversified portfolio, again, would have 84% of the market's own volatility. Now, let me try something here. I'm just curious if a beta has formed for it yet. It takes a while because you've got to get a lot of data for this and you have to do some fancy gyrations. Oh, sorry, that's insensitive. No, see, it hasn't been around long enough. And there's one of the things, too, is that when you get into a stock this young, some of the data that you would use for sound investment decisions, it isn't there. So you're more flying by the seat of your pants, so that in itself creates a risk. I don't know what the beta of this daggone thing is. Let me find something. Let me try ADM. I'm just curious about ADM. Oh, look at that. Less than half of the volatility, the systematic risk of the market portfolio. This would be something of a quite safe. If you were trying to form a portfolio that was very safe and have it in stocks, this would be something. You're going to get only half of the expected market premium over risk-free with a stock like this. Only half of the expected market premium. But it's a stable company. It's huge. It's enormous in its scale, in its scope. Try something like this.
So if the beta is less than one, it's less riskier?
It's less risky than the market portfolio. In other words, in this case, I could say that the expected return, it is 48% of the systematic volatility risk of the market portfolio. So the market portfolio is going like this. ADM's systematic component of risk would be going like this, less than half of the wildness. You've been on roller coasters before, haven't you? Have you ever seen those roller coasters like those ones out in Vegas that actually kick you out at the top of the skyscraper and then they hang you out over the skyscraper and they twirl around? Trust me, I'm not interested in dying that way, but it's not what we call a good death. But at the same time, so you've got these roller coasters that are just insane. They whip up and down and up and down. So you would say that relative to the standard roller coaster going up and down, this one goes up and down half as much. Okay, that's kind of the way you would think about it like that. Now, I was kind of curious about a couple of others, and I'll take you into, okay, Target, excuse me. Really? Okay. Notice that these companies that I'm pulling up are all big name known companies, which tends to indicate that they are going to live on. They are more secure investments. They're not crazy investments like something that would be a startup company or something like that. I was going to check something here. Stocks. Apple, Facebook, FB, Target, and oh God, now it thinks that's all I care about. Top-rated stocks. Looking at the Goldman, yeah, well, whatever. Time, Warner. See what they're doing. Beta. Again, big company, low risk. You know, I'm trying to actually find something interesting here, and it's like, Phillips Petroleum should be a low beta. Not applicable. Oh, that's kind of scary right there. But I'm going to do something. I'm going to pull up something here in just a second if I can find. Huntington should have a higher beta. Huntington, yeah, there you go. There you go, sweetie. Beta, 1.62. That's almost in the nosebleed. That's high risk. You would form around stocks like that if you were kind of like really a risk taker who wanted to get more of a Hail Mary kind of. So if you were to say something like this, let me turn this off and do this, okay.
And I'm just going to pull, do not take my number seriously here because I wouldn't give you the actual number, but I'll give you close. Let's say that right now the expected return to the market portfolio is 12.5%. That's the expected return to the market portfolio. Let's say that the current yield on a T-bill is 0.25%. They are paying so little right now, it's ridiculous. Okay? So let's look at this Huntington Bank shares, which has a beta of 1.62. So now I'm going to just crank it out. My expected return to this Huntington at this point with these numbers would be 0.2, and you can use percents. Don't forget to turn it into a real decimal if you're going to go on and use it for math or anything. But if all you're going to do is just get its expected return, you can just use the percentages in it. So I've got case of S is 0.25% plus 1.62 times 12.5% minus 0.25%. So now I can pull out and give an estimate of what I would expect to return, what I would expect on this stock. So it would be 0.25 plus 1.62 times the quantity, 12.5 minus 0.25. Oh, hello, mama. So right now, I could expect, rounded to two decimal places, remember, rounded to, that if these are the numbers that I'm working with for expected return to the market portfolio and for the risk-free rate right now, I would expect Huntington Bank shares to deliver 20.1%. About. Now, obviously, it's critically dependent upon what the expected return to the market portfolio is. You can pull this right off, the return to a one-year T-bill right off the web. That's easy enough. But the more difficult one is getting the expected return to the market portfolio. There are a lot of places that report this, and this is not too far off from where it is right now, according to conservative estimates. So there you go. That gives you an idea. Now, here's one last thing. You got any questions on this? Yeah, go ahead.
20% after how long? Like, is that 20% expected after your stock benefit for a year?
Well, it's on an annualized basis. So if you kept it for 6 months, you would expect about 10%. Yeah, so this is always annualized. I'm actually glad you brought that up because these are annualized returns. But remember, this is a buy and hold kind of thing. You're always going to... Grabbing and then dumping after a week or 2 weeks is a bad idea no matter what kind of an investor you are, unless you're a real high-powered speculator and all that. I'm going to show you something here if I can. I hope I can do it. Darn. Let's try it again. Freeport, McMoran, Goldman, Goldcorp. Yeah, Yamana. And I don't think I'm going to pull one out like this. Okay, now, something that I want to bring up, I'm not going to be able to pull one off the top of my head right now. You notice that the pivot point, here are the pivot points on beta. Zero is a risk-free instrument. A treasury bill would have a beta of zero. But I caution you, don't let me trip you. Well, a treasury bill has a beta of zero. Therefore, a treasury bill has no volatility. True or false? Why? the idea is, you see, the beta measures only the non-diversifiable risk. A treasury bill, price can go like this through the day. No, wait a minute, it's supposed to have a beta of zero? It's not supposed to do that. Well, sure it is. It's just that the part that is non-diversifiable does that, has no risk. Okay, so just keep that in mind. I might try to trip you on that.
Know it and you'll ace it. Okay, so that would be a T-bill. A beta of 1.0 would be the market portfolio. So these are sort of like the anchor points of the beta. Between 0 and 1, those are investments that don't have as much systematic risk as the market portfolio. Above 1, you have more systematic risk than the market portfolio. You expect to earn more, but you're going to take more risk for it. Like you saw with Huntington Bank shares. The market portfolio expectation was 12.5%. Huntington Bank shares had an expected return of 20.1%. Greater the risk, the greater the non-diversifiable risk, the greater the expected return. Last point here, though. Zero is the bottom of all the risk. Actually, no. There are some rare securities that have betas that are somewhat negative. In fact, you can even buy mutual funds that try to form portfolios around these negative betas. They are come under different names, but one of the popular names, you know, back from old school, we called them contrarian funds. Essentially, a contrarian fund is expected to move against the market. It's supposed to be like, well, everyone thinks the market's going to go up. I think it's going to go to hell. You go to a contrarian fund. They have negative betas. What kinds of securities would have negative betas? The one you always bring up in a class like this, gold mining companies. Because essentially gold, the old rule is this. Look. When the stock market goes bad, there's a what we call a quote-unquote flight to quality. You go to bonds, because bonds are safer than stocks, all other things being equal. So, from stocks to bonds, from bonds to gold, from gold to bullets. So, given that you can't invest in, well, yeah, you can't invest in bullet companies, but that's really... You know, that's what it's all over and we're at the zombie apocalypse. But these gold mining stocks are essentially the kinds of securities the contrarians think are great. So everyone else thinks the world is getting better. A contrarian thinks that the world is going to hell. Okay? So, you know, have you ever seen the popular internet cat called Grumpy Cat? The cat that always frowns. Now, this is their logo is Grumpy Cat. Everything is no. So they are, these contrarian funds form around betas. Now, you're not going to see huge negative betas. I've seen betas, personally, I've seen a beta of a gold mining stock at negative 0.65. But they are negative. They're contrarian. If you don't believe that the world is getting better, that we're about to go to hell, you would probably move towards these kinds of securities. There's an article that I read over the weekend, not the greatest reputation guy, but he's also not completely crazy. He seems to be of the mind that the market, we are seeing a great many of the wealthiest investors right now getting the hell out of stocks and even seeming to move out of bonds, moving toward metals. Now, you've got these metals freaks all the time saying, buy gold, everything's going to hell. All they're trying to do is drive the price of gold up insanely. It's their own world now. But at the same time, if you really, really did believe that the market, this market that's going up and up and up, and we're doing so much better now, is all temporary, and it's right, the calm right before the final storm, you go towards these contrarian funds. If, on the other hand, you think you're bullish on the market, and that's the term, if you're a bull, you think the market's going to go up. If you're a bear, you think the market's going to go down. If you're bullish on the market, move between 0 and 1. Form your portfolio in there. A couple of stocks that are 0.5s, 0.6s, 0.7s, it'll be like the weighted average, the final beta of the portfolio. If you're very bullish on the market, you go for the stocks that are even higher beta. If you're bearish, you move towards beta of 0. If you're very bearish, you go down here into the negatives if, you know, if you have to be really bearish to do that. But you have to choose your way that you're going to go. The one last piece of advice, though, is that if you let your political leanings drive your investments, you are what we call an ass. Okay? That's all I have for you. Thank you.